I'm Christopher Lydon with the novelist Nicholson Baker bursting into our poetry series with a passion for form, a longing for rhythm and rhyme, a la Kipling and Dr. Seuss. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, from the Watson Institute at Brown University. With a score of poets now, under the heading Whose Words These Are, we've been puzzling. What's it like to write serious verse these days? Who does it and why? And along comes Nick Baker, the mischievous, brilliant novelist of Vox and Human Smoke, in a daydreamy fictional monologue titled The Anthologist. Nick Baker's poetic hero, Paul Chowder, has a complete set of answers. Poetry's about dense, juicy words that want to be read slowly, he says. Writing it is slow, too. It's competitive. It's scary. Not because the words are blocked, but because the poet is afraid he's run out of them. Or that he's lost sight of the main goal, to make something memorably beautiful. Walk us into Paul Chowder's consciousness of this world of contemporary poets struggling with the legacy, struggling to say something new.
Well, Paul is my guy. He's trying to figure it all out. He's a poet of a certain age. He's somewhere in his early 50s, and he has had certain bursts of intensive poetry reading, like lots of people, non-poets and poets alike. And he wants to make sense of why this thing is worth doing. And he has doubts, partly doubts because he wonders if his own poetry is worth reading. And this just, so part of the examination is an examination of his own work, and part of it is an examination of the work that the poet, the tradition of poetry has done.
Would you give us a snippet of Paul thinking on page 39, of Paul trying to answer the question why poetry is worth thinking about?
I want to tell you, he says, and this was my job, I thought. At one point I wanted to do this as a kind of meditation because I love poetry and I've read it my whole life. Why do we mess with it? I want to tell you why poetry is worth thinking about, he says, from time to time. Not all the time. Sometimes it's a much better idea to think about other things. Most of us have a short period of intense thinking about poetry when we take a class in college, and then that's about it. And that's really all you need. One intense time when you master your little heap of names, Andrew Marvel, Muriel Rukeyser, Christina Rossetti, Hardy, Auden, Bishop, Marvin Bell, Ted Hughes, John Hollander, Nicholas Christopher, Deborah Garrison, whoever, James Wright, Selima Hill, Troy Jolimore, whoever they may be. Every so often, you remember them. If you've memorized some poems, the poems will raise a glimmering finger in your memory once in a while. And that's very nice, as long as you keep it to yourself. Never recite. Please, if you recite, your listeners will look down and play with their cuticles. They will not like you. But sometimes, if you quote just a phrase in passing, that can work. Like this. As Selima Hill says, a really good fuck makes me feel like custard. And after college, there may be later phases as well. Maybe one or two later phases where you suddenly get interested in poems again. I've had, I would say, four major phases in my life where I've been genuinely interested in poetry, interested in reading it as opposed to writing it. Because writing it is a very different activity. Writing it, it's as if the word poetry is 1,000 miles away. It's inapplicable. What I'm trying to do is make some new Roland Emmett machine that doesn't have a name. I know, of course, that it's going to end up being called a poem, but poem is one of those bothersome technical terms. It's so difficult to pronounce. You either pronounce it poem or poem or poem. It's not an English word. It's a Greek word that's had the N chopped off it, so it doesn't fit. It's got that diphthongy quality. What I'm trying to do when I'm writing poetry is I'm trying to make a little side salad. Just the right amount of sprouts on the top, maybe a chickpea or two. No bacon, maybe a slice of egg. It doesn't feel like writing at all. If you're writing, say, a book review or an essay, it's sequential. You type out some notes to figure out more or less what you're going to say, and then you find a place to start, which becomes the beginning, and you wander off in search of the end. But with a poem, you're in the middle, and then you're at the end, and then back at the beginning, all with your eyes. You're always looking at the same piece of paper. One single piece of paper is stretched out there in front of you, the lyric poem as big as the salt flats in Utah, where fearless Craig Breedlove drove his jet-powered car at 600 miles an hour. Remember him back in the 60s? I loved his name, Breedlove.
Have you, Nick Baker, written and published poems? Do you want to?
I've published one poem in The New Yorker, and I've written other poems in college. What I did in writing this book was to, I thought, okay, at some point I thought, if you're going to write a novel about a poet, you really have to write some poems in as Paul Chowder. And I did. I spent a night, I wrote something like, I don't know, 23 Paul Chowder poems, had a wonderful time, and showed them to my wife, and she said, well, you know, this is fine. It's not Paul's best work. So I suppressed them. But also I thought that, and I think this is true, when you read the memoir of a poet, it's not never very good when you read them quoting themselves at length. It doesn't work.
Nick, you're a novelist writing about poets. How does the novelist come at poets? Is it with gratitude, with envy, with a kind of smug condescension, or what?
Well, it's probably all those in different phases. But in my own case, it's gratitude, because I did a lot of my early writing on lunch hours, and a poem
about lunch hours.
About lunch hours, actually, my first book was about a lunch hour, but partly because you have a tiny moment in the middle of the day, you want things that are short. I like things that are short. I like that feeling of beginning, and poetry really gives you a lot of beginnings. I mean, and you can set out on a poem, you can be disappointed later on, but that first line, you know, you're full of good feeling toward that poem. And I like that feeling. I like the setting out feeling. And I'm not a finisher of novels. And I'm a slow reader. So all those things lead me to be very grateful to poetry, because it's giving me something dense and brief and lunch hourable, you know, that helped me enormously as I was starting out as a writer. There is a presumption in deciding that you're going to write a whole book that is in the voice of a poet. But on the other hand, a lot of what poets go through and have to play around with is similar to what the kind of prose that I do, which is not very plot heavy, is similar in some ways to, I think, the kind of writing that poets do, and that I write. I keep it, you know, sort of a diary, I guess you could say, you know, and I then think, well, what is there anything good in the last 38 pages? Probably not. Let's go back a little bit. The last 100 pages, 200 pages, anything good? Ooh, there's something here, you know, it's a paragraph. So the same kind of winnowing maybe that I do, which is radical, is the kind of stuff that poets do.
Lunch hour or late at night? Who are the poets that you would kill and die for, really?
Well, the poets that come to me unbidden, you know, that I think of as with love, I guess, are the poets of my own 20s. Elizabeth Bishop would have to be up there at the top. I wanted to be a composer when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. I played the bassoon, and I wanted to write tonal music. I wanted to rescue music from something that I thought of was a terrible mistake, which was the 12-tone artificial thing in which all music – and I went to these concerts, because I went to the Eastman School of Music for a year, and as a high school student, I basically hung out there. So I went to these modern music concerts full of my own ambition, and I'd hear a beautiful thing, an organic thing, an orchestra reduced to – You know, and then the sudden timpani. And I just thought, they are actually destroying something of value to me, you know, every time they do this. And I thought, well, I could rescue it. But I realized I couldn't rescue it because I had no real basic fundamental musical talent. I had the ability to noodle around the bassoon, which is one thing. But the real musicianly ability was lacking. And so I then moved from that to writing fiction. But at the center of that experience was the LP record, you know? Mm. And I played a lot of classical records. But I also had some poetry records. And because my mother is a great reader and lover of poetry. My father, too, would recite E.E. Cummings. My grandfather was a failed poet. He self-published one book of poems. My great-grandfather was also a sort of quiet poet who self-published a book. So I come from a long line of failed poets, I guess you could say. And so I would put these LPs on of Cademan Library, you know, Dylan Thomas, and play them, and I would listen to them the way I would listen to a symphony. Sunday morning with the big headphones on, lying up in the alcove, which is where I listen to music, and had a kind of the similar kind of experience of just letting it happen and thinking, well, Dylan Thomas is really got it, you know. So, and I got so into Dylan Thomas at one point that I memorized his whole poem. I guess it's his poem on his 35th birthday in his accent. And I worked it up. And I think I recited it at one point to my creative writing class at U of R. In the mustard seed sun, my full tilt river and fitch switch back sea with a cormorant scud. You know, and I did the whole thing and it went on for about 20 minutes. I looked around at these poor other, my fellow students thinking, what have I just done? You know, just done a complete Dylan Thomas impersonation occupying one third of the class, you know, wrong.
I'm so glad you mentioned music because you and Paul Chowder are both conversant with pop music and classical music and music in your life. Is that required of poets, do you think?
I don't think you have to have any musical talent. And in fact, oddly enough, some more extremely seemingly metrical poets really have terrible senses of rhythm. I mean, you'd have to look at John Donne is just not a good metrist. I'm sorry. But the musical, the heart of English poetry is, I think, lyric poetry, and lyric poetry means song lyrics. So when you think of the great Elizabethan poems, a lot of them were almost immediately set to music or even written to be sung to. I mean, you sang and you played the lute. Thomas Campion was a singer, and William Burroughs. And so the anthologies out of which we now pull things that we call Elizabethan poems were anthologies of songs, Elizabethan songs. So music and poetry obviously go together, and meter, you know, means a kind of, what does meter mean? I think it means feet, doesn't it? Feet like human feet, is that right? I can't remember. But anyway, we're talking about something that you want to bounce around to, hop around to sometimes. Which isn't to say that that there are not many poems that you don't want to hop around to at all. You read them and think, oh my God, that is good. And it's scary and it's powerful. But you don't necessarily want to do any of those things to it. But boy, it's nice when it does. I mean, if you look at Edgar Allan Poe or something, you know, those basic pleasures. I think what started me on this book was I bought a very simple anthology. It was called something like 101 Best Loved Poems or 101 Great Poems or something. And I collect anthologies, so I had zillions of them. And this was a reprint. And it had all these poems that were forgotten, but that had a certain kind of power because they were, because you could tap your foot to them.
Reggie Gibson, in our conversations, said The Raven was his touchstone, and recited it. And then it turned out his little six-year-old kid could recite it, too.
Yeah, the Raven, you know, when I was a kid, the Raven never did anything for me because I thought, well, that's all. You know, I don't understand that. How could the Raven be in that room? Would the Raven really be comfortable above that? I just don't see the Raven in there. But now, of course, it makes perfect sense. I mean, I read The Raven aloud to my wife and came to, and the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, chilled me with fantastic terrors never felt before. And we both went, oh, the purple curtain, the silken, sad, uncertain rustling, you know? They're just, and he's pushing it all in. And the thing is, then when you pull back from that line, and the silken, sad, uncertain rustling, you get a four-beat, you're still getting something that's a ballad. Poe was the great balladeer. 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2. You're still getting four beats, but he's crammed it full of all the syllabic density and put in colors there and the rustling. And that's what makes it great, you know, is that it has all the images and the moodiness and also, but fundamentally, also you can kind of rock to it. In the end, I think you have to say that really good song lyrics and really good poems are inhabiting exactly the same universe, and that it's useful to remember that because it changes your whole feeling about the 20th century. The 20th century, which is, you know, the series of century of modernism of T.S. Eliot, and yes, we've chorused and we moved on to the beats. And No. The 20th century was Lawrence Hart. It was Hoagy Carmichael. It was Marilyn Monroe singing, "I've locked my heart, I find no comfort there. I've shut my heart, it's icy frigid air." You know, that's the 20th century, is the most rhyme-rich, rhyme-stuffed century on record.
Maybe Tuesday will be my good news day.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a little Swinburne or something.
Exactly. Internal rhyme, which Swinburne, you know, was fantastic at. All those great lyricists would kind of secretly go back to their well-thumbed copies of Swinburne, and then jazzed up on that, they would write their own internal rhymes.
And what about the blues lyrics?
Well, that's the thing. Is the 20th century the century of free verse and modernism, or is it the century in which the stuff that's on records was so good, so fantastically, richly, excitingly good, 50s music, all that, that it actually forced what people thought of as real poetry in a corner and forced it to become extremely different, aggressively unbeautiful, in order to say, I am still poetry, I am a different thing. And if that's true, when we a couple centuries from now, when we look back at this time, what are we going to be saying about this century? I mean, it's still not determined how we're going to talk about this time. Are we going to say it's the rhymingest time, or are we going to say it's the least rhyming time? We don't know.
Paul Chowder, or the Paul Chowder in you, Nick Baker, is a passionate formalist. He thinks hard about rhyme. He adores Swinburne. Wonderful line, and maybe you should read it, about without Swinburne, we wouldn't have the American Songbook. We wouldn't have Ira Gershwin or Lawrence Hart. He loves to think hard about beats. He says there are actually three beats in a pentameter line. He's devoted to the four-beat, sort of Kipling-esque marching thing. Talk a little bit about formalism in poetry today. It's kind of fun for your reader to discover that, gosh, this very contemporary guy is nuts about the old structures.
Sure. I grew up on metrical rhyming poetry. Fact is, we all did. I mean, anybody who's read Dr. Seuss is basically has a mind full of four-beat lines. I mean, that's what he is. He's a stickler for scansion, and he's very careful about making it all work.
Let's hear your favorites of that four-beat thing.
Well, okay, let's take Kipling. because Kipling is a good example because he could do anything. He had a tremendous metrical sense. But this Kipling thing is, and what is art whereto we press through paint and prose and rhyme? Rest. When nature in her nakedness defeats us every time. Rest. So I had my poet quote that because it's part of his own defeat. The defeat is that you've got a tremendous desire to talk about what's really out there, and you have a kind of pressure to do that. And you might choose paint or prose or rhyme, but nature is so complicated and so subtle, you know, that it defeats you. And Kipling was able to kind of condense that into a perfect bouillon cube of meter. And it's a four-beat line, and it's a four-beat line because basically that's the line that we really deeply recognize as kind of the center of the poetical tradition, even though in school we're taught about other kinds of meter, and we've given a whole complicated vocabulary that really is in a sense a distraction. So I had a lot of that to say. You know, when I started off, I had my little crank theories, and I wanted to get them out there. You know? But but that isn't what started. That started a pile of notes, and the moment that I actually realized I had a novel was when I had a character who was at odds with himself. This is a guy who has really spent his whole life not writing things that are following that tradition. He's a free verse poet. I mean, he is. He accepts that he's, in a sense, and this is what worries him, gotten away with it. He's gotten away with something, you know? He's learned how to do it, and what he's doing isn't what Swinburne did. You know, it isn't what Kipling did. But he's hoping that it's still beautiful, maybe.
Is this the divided heart of poets in general, do you think?
I don't know. I've come up with a person who is, I think, true to what it's like, what it feels like to be a guy trying to do something beautiful in the world. But I'm not a poet, and I'm not trying to say that all poets are grappling with this. This is a particular guy. So no, I don't know that this is whatever. No, I don't think it's at all true that actually that. I think a lot of poets are not grappling with this at all. They said goodbye to rhyme a long time ago. It sounds jingly to them. Mm. It is jingly. And when it's bad, it's so bad. You know, rhyme when it's bad is awful. And that's part of what you have to contend with. What he's contending with, he's an anthologist, because what he wants to do is save rhyme from itself. He wants to pull out of this ocean of tiresome, jingly, kind of awful, sing-songy stuff. He wants to pull the things out, which when you read them, you go, oh, my God, that's so beautiful. You know, I really love that couplet. That's what he wants to do. He wants to save rhyme from itself.
Give us one of those examples he loves, maybe Swinburne.
Well, Swinburne is great. I mean, Swinburne is a perfect example in a way because he was so prolific. I mean, Paul Chowder's theory is that Swinburne, in a sense, created this monster. This is Chowder thinking, this monster of free verse, because he so completely over-rhymed poetry. He rhymed every word many, many times. Sea and death and all those words were rhymed at the wazoo. So once Swinburne had taken over the English language and rhymed everything up, the entire 19th century was kind of over-fertilized, and it grew this lush Swinburnian verse. And in a sense, what happened afterwards with futurism that led to imagism and modernism, those things were in revolt against this Swinburnian excess, because Swinburne wrote probably 20 times too many poems. And every poem that he wrote was 20 times longer than it should have been. That's the basic sad thing. And yet he was a tremendous genius. He was a guy who went deaf, actually, fairly early on and continued to kind of sing these crooning songs to himself and in his mind. So he wrote in every form conceivable, but one of the ones that Paul Chowder quotes is, he says, you can't understand what all those early modern futurist poets were in revolt against if you don't know about him. Swinburne says, if you were queen of pleasure and I were king of pain. Doesn't that give you a strange shudder? This is going on with Paul's narrative. If you were queen of pleasure, rest, and I were king of pain, rest. We'd hunt down love together, pluck out his flying feather, and teach his feet a measure, and find his mouth a rein. If you were queen of pleasure, and I were king of pain.
There's another passage, Nick, that's just full of, that answers the question of, you know, what a poet's actually thinking about where they're fitting these words together, where he talks about the sort of hidden waltz rhythm inside the pentameter line. There are actually, he says, there are three stresses actually in that five-beat line. Take us into the poet's head right there, where he's just kind of, he's discovered something.
Well, that it was my own little, I mean, I don't want to pretend here. I have my own theories, and I put them into Paul Chowder's mind to some degree because it's fun. That's what you get to do when you write novels. So I was sitting out in a plastic chair near a badminton net on the side of our house, and I started to say I wanted to write about poetry. Well, when you write about poetry, you have to contend with this phrase, iambic pentameter. So I started to say aloud lines of iambic pentameter that I liked. The most famous one is probably, true wit is nature to advantage dressed, what oft was thought but ne'er so well expressed, which is Alexander Pope. It's classic because it's good. But the one I was saying to myself was, all human things are subject to decay, and when fate summons, monarchs must obey. That's what I said to myself. And I started saying it faster and faster. So I would say, all human things are subject to decay. Rest. And when fate summons, monarchs must obey. Rest. And as I said it to myself, I realized that it wanted to fall, to be conducted, to be marched, not marched to, but waltzed to a certain way. So when I realized that I had this to me, exciting discovery, I thought, you know, I've got a novel here. And I rubbed my hands together and wrote lots of notes. And I didn't have a novel because I had a theory, but it was an extreme enough theory that it seemed to me the right thing for a fictional character to have. This guy has strong opinions. And the great liberating thing about writing it as a novel is you can just follow out those strong opinions. You can just lay it out and realize you're being inconsistent with yourself, but you're telling it as truthfully as you know how to tell it that afternoon out in the side yard. You're doing your best. That's what a novel allows you to do, is do your best at that moment and not worry about the fact that you're not coming up with a codified, perfectly consistent body of theory that you can publish as a new doctrine of rhyme. One of his problems is that he can't get it all out. And this is a problem for me, is if you have lots of theories about something, and it could be anything, it doesn't have to be about poetry, but it's just sort of as if it's all pressing. It all wants to be said simultaneously. So how do you feed it out bit by bit? How do you choose a certain order? And the way I chose the order was by setting myself up in different places in my house and speaking it, because I find that speaking things forces you to choose. I mean, you have to choose one word after another. So if you're writing, it's sometimes very tempting to say, well, I'll write a few notes on this, but it'll connect in with this over here. And no one will know it, but it'll be a little secret connection. And then I'll have a whole chapter back later that'll deal with this? And so you get this kind of three-dimensional structure in your mind. It's very interesting, but has nothing to do with the logic of what of the way people are going to be taking it in, which is word by word. So I force myself to sit down and try to explain poetry word by word. And I did it, you know, I set up a video camera and I set myself up as an explainer. I got one of those easels, those paper easels, you know, with the Sharpie pens, and I wrote things out and I tried to really put myself in the frame of mind of somebody who's trying urgently to explain this thing that's really complicated, because it seemed to be worth doing, you know. But also,
you actually did all of those physical things.
Oh, sure, yeah, I did. I have about 40 hours of videotape. Wow. You know, and the difficulty with doing it that way, of course, is that you have to transcribe. That's the good part and the bad part. The good part is that you transcribe it once and then you realize that it was too on the nose. And so you go back the next day and you set up in a different place. So by the fourth or fifth time I explained something, I gotten to the point where I was kind of loose with it and playful and bored with what I wanted to say and interested in some little side light, which is truer, you know.
That's so fascinating as a instruction in kind of novelistic method. And it accounts sort of for the granularity and the humor and the digression and the different sizes and shapes of the ideas you're playing with there. Sometimes they're received opinions, like Theodore Retke's opinion that there are only actually 15 poets at any one time in the world. Or Paul is fascinated with the suicides in poetry, how they die, how many end their own lives, etc. Some of these are big theories, some of them are little, some of them are stray, some of them are important. How do you know? Or how do you sift them out? Or do you?
Well, you don't know until you've sat down and tried to explain it. What is most pressingly, urgently asking to be said that Thursday at 11 o'clock in the morning? What is it? What is it about poetry? What is it about the lives of poets? And if you set up a character like this one who is asking something impossible of himself. He has to write an introduction to poetry. Well, you think, well, that's not that hard. And it only has to be something like, you know, 20, 30, 40 pages long. But for him, it's impossible because he's trying to introduce, in a sense, it's an anthology of rhyme. He's trying to introduce his own failure. I mean, he has failed to become one of the great rhyming poets. I mean, he's not Yeats. He's not Keats. He's just Paul Chowder. You know, he's a failure. So he's introducing his own deficiency. And he's also going to think about the fact that God dang it, he's not that depressed. And a lot of poets are really depressed. And look at them all. I mean, look at Auden, who would, you know, carry a bottle of wine to bed with him every night and shuffle around in his bedroom slippers. Look at Louise Bogan, who wrote, you know, these poems, who would just go into these massive, almost inspiring depressions, you know? I mean, the depressions were so massive that you almost think, I want one of those, you know? At midnight, tears run in your ears, you know? And she said she was a genius and wrote some immortal stanzas. And although she's, you know, sort of a lesser figure, I guess, in the pantheon. So he thinks about all these people and whether how he measures up and whether he does measure up. And so that, all those urgencies kind of force him down to the saying of one thing then. So that's what I did, was I said it in the guise of Paul Chowder. And I often, so sometimes I would say, hello, welcome to this is the Paul Chowder show. You know, I try to come up with different ways of saying it. I actually fantasized about having a podcast, you know, that would be called the Paul Chowder Poetry Hour, the Paul Chowder Thimble Squirt of Rhyme, you know, some way of getting it out, because it seems like sometimes the recursive things where you come back to a theme week after week, you get at the truth better than if you try to say it all in one go. And in the end, I had all these pieces, and the pieces then had to assume some order, and I figured out some ways to do that.
You know, Nick, we've been talking to a lot of poets in the last couple of months, really just kind of wondering in a time when politics is not clear, journalism is not clear, wondering sort of who's keeping score of the bigger questions. And I must say, I'm drawn to poets and poetry in a completely new way. They are the unacknowledged legislators after all, and they are thinking about things and trying to say things that the New York Times won't tell you.
Well, what is a poem? A poem is something that a person somewhere decided to call a poem. That's the first thing. And what does it ask of us is that it asks of us to read it slowly. I think that's the key, is that that a poetry is a bunch of words that's just making a polite request to be read slowly. And there are all sorts of other things that it can do. It can rhyme. It can thump along in a kind of wonderful, galumphing way or not. But it mainly is asking us to slow down.
Mm.
And I like that. I mean, I think that I often read, I'm not a very fast reader, but even though I'm not a fast reader, I read too quickly. And I've found that the thing that's most helpful to me as a writer is to slow myself down artificially. The way I do that is by getting a spiral notebook and copying things out. Because if you copy something out, you are forced to write at the speed of writing, which is really, really slow. So, that comma that you come across, you've had to make that little comma shape. So you're slowing yourself down, and I found that that's very helpful. Mm. And I also, one of the things I wanted to do in this book was to put my little hard-won hoard of tips and tricks into book form. You know, although it's a work of fiction, here are some things that actually helped me learn how to write. And one of them was to read poetry. I, as a fiction writer, learned how to write prose by reading poetry. So I have a great debt that I owe to this tradition. I carried around the New Yorker Book of Poems and Howard Moss's poems and Stanley Kunitz's poems with me when I was working in New York on Wall Street, read them on my lunch hour. So I have that. But also there are other tips. And one of them is to, you know, something that you really like, slow yourself down artificially. It may seem artificial, but slow yourself down by copying it out. If you copy it out, you'll really read it for the first time.
Hmm. Rosanna Warren showed us her own little commonplace book and stuff that she memorizes too. The tips on method are so interesting and individual, but I'm also discovering that there's an amazing vitality of poets out there. I'm so glad to know Paul Chowder's in the game, but also Franz Wright, son of James, and Stephen Burt, and Michael Ansara, who hasn't published yet. But praise God, there's a lot of it out there.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of poetry out there, and I think that old Paul Chowder is not up to date the way he should be, which is true, I think, of a 50-year-old poet. What he's thinking about is the poets who excited him when he was just starting out and he had these ambitions, and the people that excited him were the people who excited me, Howard Moss and Stanley Kunitz and Snodgrass and the people in the New Yorker Anthology of Poems. But there are zillions of people out there, and some of them are good, some of them are bad. Maybe we have to have this tremendous, one of the things he says is, you know, don't think about the wastefulness of poetry, not just the wastefulness now, but the wastefulness of the 19th century. Don't think about it, or it will just appall you to think of Tennyson, who wrote all those thousands and thousands of lines, and it comes down to, you know, the Kraken and a couple of other poems. Don't think about it, because it's horrifying. It really is. And yet that's what it's all about. You have to have this tremendous inefficiency. You have to have this swelling of a million hearts, stuff pouring out, and then it kind of, it's filtered, and one anthology filters it, and it somehow arrives at an anthology life and lives on by being passed forward. That's the thing. That's why poets are so fascinated by anthologies. That's immortality. If you don't live in an anthology, you don't live. And in fact, I quote, or I talk about one poet, Shapiro, Carl Shapiro. He was in this Oxford Book of American Verse, you know. He was there. He was there. His poems were there for a while. And then they got a new editor, and the new editor cut him out. And he said it was like a death. And it did, because that is where a poet lives, is in these anthologies that then feed future anthologies and get winnowed. And it's a fascinating thing, the life of poems and anthologies.
Mm. You speak about Paul Chatter wondering how he's doing, where he stands. Would you read that wonderful passage late in the book about the poet's ladder that he worries about?
Yeah. I wish I were happy in a disciplined way, happy in a non-despairing way. I wish I could spill forth the wisdom of 20 years of reading and writing poetry, but I'm not sure I can. I've published poems, yes, that much is beyond question, and for a while I was pleased with the poems that I published. I felt that I understood why people write poetry. I understood the whole communal activity of writing and reviewing and extracting quotes to go on the paperback. Moss has arrived with next to no luggage at mastery, being part of the interfaith blurb universe. Now it's like I'm on some infinitely tall ladder. You know the way old aluminum ladders have that texture, that kind of not too appealing roughness of texture, and that kind of cold gray color? I'm clinging to this telescoping ladder that leads up into the blinding blue. The world is somewhere very far below. I don't know how I got here. It's a mystery. When I look up, I see people climbing, rung by rung. I see Jory Graham. I see Billy Collins. I see Ted Kooser. They're all clinging to the ladder, too. And above them, I see Auden, Kunitz. Whoa, way up there, Samuel Daniel, Sarah Teasdale, Herrick, tiny figures, clamoring, clinging. The wind comes over, whoosh, and it's cold, and the ladder vibrates, and I feel very exposed and high up. Off to one side, there's Helen Vendler in her trusty dirigible, filming our ascent. And I look down, and there are many people behind me. They're hurrying up to where I am. They're 23-year-old, energetic climbing creatures in their anoraks and goggles, and I'm trying to keep climbing. But my hands are cold and going numb. My arms are tired to tremblement. It's freezing, and it's lonely, and there's nobody to talk to. And what if I just let go? What if I just loosened my grip and fell to one side and just let go? Would that be such a bad thing?
Mm. Your anthologist, Paul Chatter, is blocked. He's frustrated. His girlfriend has left in her impatience. And yet, I hope we're not supposed to think of him as a failure. I mean, to me, he's probably your typical poetic career, right?
Well, what he's hoping secretly, I think, is that, you know, this introduction, quote unquote, that he's writing will be the poem of his life. This is going to be the poem that he's been waiting to write all the way through. And it's finally going to come out. And it's going to come out because he's going to be able to sing this pain of being unable to write the anthology. So I think, I'm hoping that there's a kind of a success here, or a happy ending, in that he manages to get something out that's true to life and true to the reading of poems that he has kind of stored away in himself, and that this is the poem that he's been wanting to write. It happens to be prose, but then again, a lot of contemporary poetry is, as Rettke himself said, highly wrought prose. I mean, that's what it is. It's a heap of dense, juicy, twisty words that ask you to think about them carefully. And that's what he's trying to do with this novel.
Well, in the end, surely I want to say, you know, stick with it, Paul. That's the way it's supposed to be. It's tough, but you're doing it for us. You're doing it for all time. You're doing fine.
Well, I want to tell him that too. And in fact, I was, you know, I'm trying to urge him on. You know, I would. But one thing is that this word "blocked," I think, is always been a problem for me. Is that
slap me down here? Go ahead.
No, I'm not saying that. I mean, I think that's the way this book is. I think it may even be on the flap that he's a blocked writer, and I have had many periods of my life where I don't want to write, or where I just feel I don't have anything to say, and that seems to me a true emotion. I've never had the feeling that I was so urgently and powerfully full of a particular gigantic message, but that I was like some kind of Greek figure pushing against a granitic obstacle. I have never been blocked, you know, which is not to say that I haven't a lot of times just had nothing to say. And this is Paul Chowder's fear, I think, is that he isn't blocked. You know, what has he got? Maybe he has nothing. Maybe he looks in the bowl of self and there's not a heck of a lot there. And that's what scares him. If he were blocked, it might be better.
Well, we're all Chowder people at the end. Aren't we?
Well, you know, we're all Chowder people, maybe in the sense that we're all mixed. I mean, I like the name Chowder because it's kind of a mixed, it's kind of a corn chowdery feeling of lots of different things in there in the bowl, and that's what human beings are.
The other thing I've come to treasure about poets in these conversations is simply the independent stance on the times we live in, politically, technologically, culturally, globally, or otherwise. Does Paul Chowder have sort of a view of these times? Do you?
I have many views of these times, but I think that sometimes it's good to just leave that out. You know, just say what you've put away the newspaper and gone outside, and the birds are chirping. Sometimes they're annoyingly chirping, but sometimes they're, you know, trying to say something to you, and you've got a chair and the sunlight's hitting your face in an interesting way. Do you really want to think about what was in the paper that morning? Or do you want to think about trying to create something beautiful, some set of reasons for why life is worth living? If that's what you really want to do, you probably want to filter out all the outrage and indignation and unhappiness for a time, to say, if we solved all the problems, if everything was flat and everything was okay and there was no pain in the world, what would we look around for? Well, we'd probably look around for a poem. All right, well, if that's what people are going to look around for, or a painting or a piece of music or something, if that's what people are going to look around for, then maybe it's my job to write it.
Thank you, Nick Baker. Thank you for Paul Chowder. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me on this show. I love it.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Nicholson Baker about his alter ego, the poet Paul Chowder, in his new novel, The Anthologist. Our Brown University interns Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson keep reading up with us in this continuing series with poets whose words these are. Post your own reassurance that poetry is worth doing, that we're still built for rhyme and rhythm, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for joining the conversation.